Mindfulness begins with realistic worldview. Intelligence is part of mindfulness from the beginning. If you feel nervous that mindfulness will intensify your awareness and intelligence, I'm sorry if I'm ruining your mindfulness practice. If you think it just means being okay, here I am. Because that isn't really it. It's being more aware of who's I? Who is I? What does I refer to? If you really become more aware of here I am, you will have trouble finding what I actually refers to. What am refers to. What is here, actually? What is here? Right? Did you ever, you know, there's an ancient Buddhist, not ancient, there's a recent Buddhist exercise that I always do with people. Where is your nose? Do you think you know where your nose is? Does everyone here think so? I see someone with their hand like this. Okay. Well, so everyone can go like that. But then, am I touching my nose? In a sense, we can say yes. But say I got in the clutches of some terrible plastic surgeon like poor Michael Jackson was victimized by, and he decides to fix my nose. What I am now touching would no longer be my nose. It's not really my nose. It at the moment seems to be a part. But anyway, there's not really an it, because if I press harder, my fingertip touches a larger surface. If I press less hard, it's only a little bit. My fingertip is not a point, and therefore, and every point on my nose, by the way, is not on my nose, right? XY point has no size. It's not a little dot. So there is no point on my nose. All the points on my nose are not on my nose. You know, like plastic surgeon has a thing where he shows you your nose and he does a little blip, 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 and your nose goes like this, and it goes like that, and you want one like this and that, you can fix your nose, right? But actually, all those points are just a mathematical abstraction, and no point on your nose is your nose. And then, where's the boundary between your nose and your cheek? Between your nose and your brow? Between your nose and your upper lip? Where is it? A line has no width, so you can't actually find the boundary between your nose and your cheek. So if you do that thought experiment long enough, you will realize emptiness. You'll become enlightened when you truly can realize that you cannot find your nose. On the other hand, as I say, it's good to do it with the nose, because the nose, for most of us, unless we're Orientals or have a very small nose, it's our lifelong hood ornament. Right? It sort of goes down the street ahead of us, like one of those, like in the old days out of Pontiac, you had like a person like that. Goddess. Prow, you know, it's your prow. But actually, you can't even find your nose. So how can you find your eye? What does it mean? And don't give me ego, all you therapists. Ego was not used by Freud. Freud used the word the ich. The I in German. Ego is the Greek pronoun. That's all it is. If you go and want some rice pudding in Greece, you say, ego wants rice pudding. They don't think it's some technical term. But where does it land, that pronoun? Where is your I? Where is your ego? You see? It's like it's a conventional thing. It's a relative thing. It's something which is there only when you don't look for it too hard. When you look for anything very hard, it will dissolve under your gaze. This is, Buddha discovered this. This is the key to emptiness, which doesn't mean nothingness, doesn't mean empty space. People who say, oh, just visualize space, that's nonsense. It's a waste of your time. The emptiness means that there is no non-relative thing. Everything is empty of any non-relative component, is what emptiness means. So it means that the absolute is all of the relativity, and therefore it's a kind of total relativity, which we are totally interconnected in. We're totally interwoven with, is this total relativity. We'll never leave it. You'll never get out of here. Never. My slogan is, I'm often asked to teach on the Book of the Dead, which is one of my slightly better works. And my slogan there is, nobody gets out of here a dead. you're still, everyone in your family who passed away is still there. But it doesn't mean they're up in heaven waiting for a cookie necessarily, an offering. They might be your neighbor. They might be your neighbor's child. They might be dog and cat. They might be the chicken. You never know. Therefore, the Tibetans, for example, who really got mainstream about the biological theory known as karma, or causality, evolutionary causality, which is all it is. It's not some fate. It's not some mystical religious thing. It's evolutionary causality. And when they really fully went into it, they're not really into ancestor worship. They're not into, like, my blood, my race, my family, my clan. Because people are born in each other's families and clans and races and nations and genders. The evolutionary theory completely erodes all of those... Exactly. There's my grandpa right there. Could be. Or grandma. Hello. Yes, you happy. You are somebody's grandpa and grandma. Back for another round. And you don't want to be spoiled by your mom because you want grandma to spoil you. And, you know, when our children spoil our grandchildren too much, it's very annoying. Because when we show up and they're having chocolate for breakfast, and we brought that grandparent chocolate to spoil them with, and what can we do? We just look disapproving and talk about diet. And we're not popular. It's terrible. Mindfulness. It's not true. Oh yeah. Well, anyway. So realistic worldview. So basically, realistic worldview doesn't mean believing in Buddha. It doesn't mean believing in spirit. Doesn't mean believing in anything really in a way except believing in causality and relationality. It means. So it means being critical of theories of some absolute that is controlling the relative, or outside of the relative, or inside ourselves, that's controlling, that there's an absolute, that the self is absolute. That's, of course, the key place where the rubber really hits the road. Okay? Now, you will all say, I never think myself is absolute. But when you really lose your temper, which, of course, very few of you do since you practice mindfulness, but if you ever have, you know very well that you become completely reckless and you behave as if there's an absolute force in what you're doing that is disregarding relationships. You say things you don't mean that are very harmful. You will break things that are harmful. People will even kill themselves, the relative body and life of themselves. Because this absolute thing says, I'm so absolute, this mood is so absolute, I have to do what it tells me to do. Right? So that shows that we have this psycho core when we're unenlightened. And it is the seeing through that psycho core that the first step in is realistic worldview, which is everything is related, everything is caused and effect. And it's basically acceptance of causality. Buddha, the famous verse about Buddha, Om ye dharma hetu prabhava hetun tesham tathagata hi abadat. The cardinal verse of all of Buddha's teaching, of Buddhist psychology, which means of all things that arise from causes, the Buddha knew what were the causes, said what were the causes, and how they are terminated, blown away. That was the path that he taught. That was his teaching. So he's like discovery of causation was a big deal. Nowadays we hear people saying, oh no, I'm into synchronicity, causation is so simplistic, and blah, blah, blah. But actually, before the discovery of causation, people thought the gods were in charge of everything and they were running around doing rituals, trying to get the gods to be nice to them, and they felt very helpless. So beginning to discover that things were caused was a huge breakthrough for human beings, because then they could interfere with these causes and make better causes for better things. And you're therapists and psychologists, and you want to get rid of the negative things of the mind, and you want to reinforce the positive things in the mind. That's your job, for yourself and others. And actually, first for yourself, hopefully. Although, actually, people attracted to the field are often a little bit out there, which is a good sign, actually. It's good to be a little out there. If you're just completely normal in an insane culture, that's not a good sign. And we do have a little bit imbalanced culture, actually. We are not really, we think we're very superior, and we think we're modern, and we have great science departments and stuff. But first of all, we think that we've discovered nothing, which is completely, shows a little bit tinge of insanity, A. And B, we are the first culture in history to be bringing the planet to the brink of utter destruction, either by violence or by pollution and greed. And no one else did that. Our first Americans, you have the better term than we do in the south of here, the first Americans, you call them, they never brought things to the brink of destruction. They did not. They had problems, but they didn't do that. They didn't get into the theory that if we can invent it and manufacture it, no matter how harmful it is, we should, because otherwise someone else will. They didn't get into that theory. That we're helpless, in other words, victims of our own ingenuity or something. So then once you have this realistic worldview where you are a causal evolutionary being, and there's no limit to the consequences of how you live and what you do, then you become motivated to do better things. Then true mindfulness, the real energy of mindfulness, begins there. Because there's a wonderful statement, who understands cause in the Samadhi Raja Sutra, the discourse of the king of Samadhi. Samadhi means like meditative concentration. So in that sutra it says, who understands cause and effect will understand emptiness. The absolute, in other words, which is the absoluteness of relativity, actually. Not any kind of separated absoluteness that is relevant to the relative. And once they understand the emptiness, they will become truly mindful of the most minute things, truly aware. Why? Because every little thing can be a little better or a little worse, including thought. And this is why Buddhist societies in history, and Taoist and Hindu, and in general in the East, and actually earlier Christian mystical and Sufi-dominated ones, so it isn't necessarily an East-West thing. They had so many centers of meditation of some kind of self-development. They had so many of them because they became aware that the state of your mind is the most powerful thing that you do. What you go and do with your hands and your feet and your speech is very powerful and important, and it has consequences. And what you say can be better or worse. What you physically do can be better or worse. But what you think can be better or worse, and what you think will guide what you say and do, and it has very powerful evolutionary impact, and when you die, it's what you're thinking that will go with you. It's what you think will be imprinting the deepest, subtlest nature of your mind, your unconscious, and that's what will go, your eros and your thanatos. It's what Freud talked about. And therefore, in Buddhist psychology, this is a really important point for you therapists. In Buddhist psychology, there is zero tolerance for an unconscious. And I don't mean that they don't know there is an unconscious in normal people, unenlightened people. But there's zero tolerance for the idea that everyone is going to stay unconscious. In other words, the project becomes, become conscious of your unconscious. Cleanse your unconscious. You know the Greek myth of the Augean stables by Hercules, cleaning up the Augean stables. Isn't it Augean? Yeah, Augean stable. This is like about cleaning up the subliminal areas of the mind, not saying, well, that's just a thing that I have. You know, Freud was a genius and a wonderful man in his way. He didn't do crack, actually. He had the real stuff. Actually, as a writer, he was quite famous for his cocaine habit, actually. And he wasn't arrested by George Bush. But maybe he was. Maybe it was not good for his health. I don't know. He had a robust health. And but he did lead to the one aspect of our culture that is really very unfortunate, you know. Like I used to teach at a liberal arts college that prided itself on really getting at the essence of Western culture. And one of the big courses that we were all forced to teach, even whatever our field, was Darwin, Marx, and Freud, you know, makers of the modern world, you know. But one thing I noticed that they didn't notice somehow in singing the praises of these people was, oh, thank you. One thing that I noticed was that all three of them lead a person to feel absolutely helpless and in need of some authoritative person to help them. In Darwin, right, we have Richard Dawkins, the high priest of the selfish gene, rushing off to like re-encourage us that we don't really matter because the selfish gene is taking care of it. And, you know, Sam Harris or whatever, all these kind of guys. And then, so we're just being pushed around by our genes. We have no free will about it, right? Then Marx, oh, our social position. Really, we think we're making a choice, but actually it's determined by our position. And we lack sociological apperception, as they call it, sociological self-awareness. And we just do what we're a product of our social position. And then Freud, the unconscious pushes us around. And then mom and dad are up there in the superego, and they're making the unconscious uncomfortable. In between, we're all squeezed, and so we go to a therapist. But we're never going to get rid of that unconscious, and so we just want to like vent it a little bit here and there. And so the modern world means that we're Charlie Chaplin in modern times. We're helpless. Buddha, the psychotherapist. Buddha, and the Four Noble Truths, by the way, is a medical diagnosis. It's not a religious, you could call them the Four Noble Facts. There's a diagnosis, an etiology, a prognosis, and a therapy. That's what the Four Noble Truths are. So he's really the patron saint of therapists, actually. It's original therapy for psychotic human beings, which are all of them, who think that they're going to get away with it, whatever it is. So they don't have to live up to their full awareness, their full mindfulness. They can pretend that they're noticing this and not noticing that underfoot, and it's not going to have any consequence to them, which we all do, and which is unrealistic of us. So realistic worldview is by becoming more mindful, we become more responsible about everything in our field and orbit. We guys become more like our wives, actually. I'm sorry to say. I hope some of the guys are offended. Because it might make them think. So then you have that. Then after a realistic motivation about living fully aware and fully awake and fully alert, which every little baby step of mindfulness brings us towards. Every little baby step brings us towards. Don't go into a thing of like, oh, I went to the retreat center for the weekend routine or the week or the month or whatever, and then I was really mindful. I was 1, 2, 3, breathe, 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 breathe. And then I come back and then it didn't work. I'm still a pain. I still have pain, you know, all this kind of thing. Don't do that. And therefore, I'll never bother with it again. Ignorance is bliss. I want to get back to ignorance. No, baby steps, baby steps. Even a month of retreat, even 3-year retreat is a baby step because it's an evolutionary process. Waking up, becoming fully enlightened, becoming what we can evolve to become as human beings is an evolutionary process. It could take 1,000 lifetimes. We don't care, actually. Time is irrelevant when you realize you are an immortal being that is immortally changeable. And therefore, you are committed to changing yourself in a positive way. You have to. It's not a choice. You've got, of course, then you choose how to do that. That's a choice. But that you have to do it, you have to. When I wrote a book called Infinite Life, which I was very pleased, I still like it. And my editor was really annoyed about it. She wanted me to write something popular, like Mindfulness in the Can or something. You know. And although that's a good place to be mindful. And she thought that would sell better. So she tried every way to make, although actually the publisher can change your title, unfortunately, when they show you the fine print. But they didn't want to do that because they want you to sell it, so they don't want to really make you mad. So she tried to persuade me. The final thing she said to me was, "You don't want to go around promising people infinite life, do you?" I says, no, I want to go around threatening them with it. Then she was quiet. But then she ruined my subtitle. She got revenge. My subtitle was Breaking Free of the Terminal Lifestyle. And she said, oh no, you can't say that. It sounds like a disease. I said, exactly. Someone who lives like here now, gone tomorrow, and forget about it, the no consequences, a reckless, irresponsible, disfrustrated, and frustrating person. And their life is meaningless to them, and they will have a meaning of being a pain to others. That's that kind of person. A society that lives like that will be damaging and destructive. So yes, you're going to be here for the consequences of how you've lived. Yes, definitely. There's no way out. And therefore, you want to be, and you can, I'm not threatening anybody with a negative infinite life, you can have a great one. You can be better than even Canadian person in Toronto and the talk that's soon about to end, because they are going to come and strangle me. You can be even better. You can be more intelligent. Guys can be female and be more sensitive and have more fun and maybe be in a society where they won't be downtrodden and told to be quiet, dear. I'm guilty of it. Listen, guys, I'm terrible chauvinist. My wife, I'm 73 years old. She told me, she said, I guess to judge by you, men at around 70 seem to emerge from adolescence. So I'm in the boat with you. Don't worry. I've shown improvement, actually. I've been married 47 years, and I have not yet been accepted as a disciple. I'm still a novitiate. I'm like that guy outside in the Zen Center sitting in the rain waiting to be let in. I don't know why he wants to get in. Then when he's in there, they whack him with a stick. Okay, so then realistic motivation about living right, thinking right. And then you got to go to a thinking place. You got to go, you know, shrinks can help you think better. Other people, you need to talk to other people. And meditation can help you think better. And they're very valuable tools that you need to learn to develop skill about how to manage your mind and be more awake, certainly. But then before you get to mindfulness and the Eightfold Path, we only have two. There's realistic action, evolutionary action, karma. There's realistic livelihood. There's realistic speech. Those three things which are all in the ethical area, and realistic effort. And that, you know, creativity and effort is not any kind of effort. It's not working to make missiles and bombs and make $1 billion or whatever, you know, trampling on people and whatever. Although it's good to make $1 billion if you give it away, that's good. That's a good thing to do with $1 billion. And bodhisattvas like to do that. But anyway, realistic creativity, I like to translate instead of just effort. So those are the six. And then the seventh thing, when you've created that foundation of realistic worldview, realistic motivation, realistic action, realistic evolutionary action, realistic livelihood, don't do anything harmful to being, don't have a livelihood that harms being, realistic speech and realistic creativity, creative effort, finally, realistic mindfulness. Smriti, remembrance, you get to that. Because then that built on that basis of an ethical, of a realistic worldview about what's real and what's unreal, which means in our case, because we are so deeply ingrained in our materialism, and I don't mean, you know, Madonna's materialism, I mean scientific materialism. We're so ingrained in it, we think it's so cool. It takes a big critical effort to realize how hollow it is, actually. It's totally pretentious and hollow and unevidenced. Filled with dogmatic assertions, in fact, and unphilosophical, and takes critical work to do it, but anyone can do it with common sense. They can break free of that bit by bit and realize they are in a sea of constantly changing causation, and that therefore they must take responsibility for what causes what state of existence of theirs and those around them. And that will cause them, within that motivation, and then with the ethical foundation not to live too distracted by being in too much in conflict with everybody, then they can really begin to become, remember, and become mindful. And it won't be too painful. You know, there's this whole thing about non-judgmental that you hear about a lot in the clinics where people do mindfulness, you know, and the neuroscientists tell them, yeah, it'll help your blood pressure and your brain. Your right brain will run over and tell your left brain to be quiet and all this stuff they tell you. And then neuroscience says, so, oh, I can do that. It's like, we're like that because we're conditioned like that. But that's not true that it's not judgmental. Mindfulness is judgmental. That's the point of it. You become more aware and you don't like the negative things that you see. But you know, when people are living in an unethical culture, in an unethical livelihood, in an unethical way of behaving, then they don't want to look at themselves, of course, because they don't want to see how they are behaving. So then non-judgmental is good. So I like it that they say that. So then people can think, oh yeah, okay, I can just be me. I don't have to judge it. And then but then they will, of course, when they see what a pain they are. They'll notice it. We do. We finally get then, mindfulness relates to another thing called conscience, which is really important. And then the eightfold thing is samadhi, is concentration, meditation. Samadhi. And the word dhi means intelligence again. Dhi. And ah means focused on something, the long ah, addressing something, ah. So intelligence, addressing something, and sam means totally addressing it. Samadhi. So that means when your mind can be one-pointed on whatever it is you want to do. And that's when you really take charge of your existence and you can really be of benefit to yourself. And you can really be of benefit to others. You can be a really, truly great therapist. You can therapize yourself, heal yourself first, very much, with those eight things. And you can be happy, actually. You can be cheery. There's a few Buddhists running around saying, it's not about happiness. They're all grumpy looking. because they want to be the boss. I think they suck. I don't care if they're Tibetan or Japanese. They can come from Mars. They can have a big ears like Mr. Spock. If they want to be the boss and use spirituality to try to be the boss, that's where religions become broken. In this Istanbul conference, I came up with a good slogan that I like. I'm going to share with you. Religions are service industries. They're there to serve people. And they've done a good job. They've existed a long time. There's a lot of abuse because always everything goes wrong. If we humans can screw up any good thing, well, we are good at it. But they've done a lot of things that they wouldn't still be there. But where they go wrong is where they think they own their adherents. And then they start competing with each other for market share. And then they boss them around. They tell them, without us, you're doomed. Only through the Mother Church. Only through the Dharma Center, only through the Dislama, only through that sect, only through the Zendo, you're going to get there. And they look really grumpy. And if you say, oh, thanks, that's nice, but I'm going shopping, then they're like, well, you're not happy. No. And they get all grumpy. But actually, Buddha is about happiness. Why do you like the Dalai Lama when he comes here? He's happy. And he's happy himself, but he's very upset about his people being genocided, and the Chinese trying to pretend they don't exist, and the world, and especially the Brits, pretending they never did exist. The Brits are the ones who know exactly that they exist. They had treaties with them. They pretend they never did. I know you still love the Queen. I like the Queen, although I'd like Charles, frankly, to have a shot before he's... You know, but you know, it'd be all right. It'd be a 90-year-old coronation ceremony. It's possible at this rate. It'll have to be. And I'm sorry, that's a digression, I know. So I know you do that, but the Tibet is too bad. So Dalai Lama is very unhappy about it. But he's happy personally because you have to be happy. He couldn't help Tibet if he wasn't happy. You have to see the deepest nature of happiness is reality of the universe. You have to keep in touch with that to whatever little degree you can. Actually, if you're not, you'll lose your health. You will lose your health if you indulge in being unhappy. Oh, I lost so-and-so. Ah, I didn't get that. Ooh. And resenting the other, feeling bitter. Then you won't get sick. Because you'll shut down the bliss of your cells. The bliss of your antibody. Your immune system is your bliss. Doesn't like grumpy cancer cells. Cancer cells are more grumpy. Actually, they're pretty happy too. They're just in the wrong place. So it is about happiness. Mindfulness is really about happiness. And judgment doesn't spoil the happiness. Once you, when you're happy, you can, even, I mean, everybody knows this. It's even in the Zoloft commercial. There's that lady in the kitchen. I don't know if they show it up here in Canada. There's that lady in the kitchen. The dog just did some horrible thing. The baby threw the food on the floor. The thing is burning in the thing. The horrible husband comes in like, where's my coffee? And she's like, eh. And then she looks out the window and there's a field of yellow flowers and it comes, Zolo! And then suddenly she wipes it up. She's got the right paper towel and this, and she puts the GMO manufactured crappy waffle in the toaster, and she got this, and the baby is like made of plastic, and the dog is like whatever, he's got Zoloft too, and everybody's fine. So they know that when you're happy, you can handle it. It's because you have a strength, because you're in line with reality when you're happy. Those people with the quadruple axle, the ones who are happy, are the ones who succeed. They get so well-trained, and they get so clear, they get confident, and then they just do it blissfully. And then they don't worry, they land perfectly. Now they're just like, stop. And you know, everybody knows that. And Buddha's not like, Buddha's a psychiatrist, a realistic one, who's like very, that's all, and he didn't have a therapy institution. Therapy was being given by grumpy Vedic priests who were sacrificing animals around the corner and acting pious and like, I'll get God to do this and that for you. And he wanted to really help people. And he became the great founder of healing in the world, actually. He really did. Ayurveda, you know, Vayu Kapha Pitta, that is desire, hatred, and delusion, the three poisons of the mind. Buddha's discovery, actually. And then they resonate into the Yoga Sutras, into this and that. But that's his thing. You know, they think it came from Dhanvantara and from Brahma and all this, but actually the Buddhist monks started it. Historically, but the Brahmins forgot about, you know, because of the last 1,000 years, poor guys. You know. So that's, I'm sorry, that's the digression. But anyway, I think I ran out of time, although I didn't really get started. I did. I had a great slideshow. I had a great slideshow proving Buddha was really more a scientist, you know, and that you can praise Buddha. Like, you know, we don't think we're being sectarian or fanatics when we say Einstein was a great scientist, and he was correct about relativity, and he was making a quantum leap, or Heisenberg, or Niels Bohr. You know, there is a right and wrong in science. There is a correct and incorrect, and we don't think it's being fanatical about it. In religions, you don't want to go saying, oh, this is great and that is not great. That's bad. That's ridiculous. Actually, the first Indian emperor, or the great emperor Ashoka, who was the biggest patron of the Buddha Dharma in the history of India, or perhaps the world, he actually, in his old age, he gave the entire kingdom to the Buddhist monks, which they cleverly went and they sold it back to his heirs for a modest sum, because they knew they'd be exterminated if they didn't. He said, we don't, you know, it's really bad to denigrate others' beliefs and religions. The way you show the greatness of your own is to develop yourself to fulfill its ideals. In the 3rd century before the Common Era, he wrote that on a stone pillar, so it's unquestionably his statement. 2,300 years ago, he said, we don't need this kind of fighting between sects and religions. We support all of those people who try to live by the ideals of their spiritual teachings, because they become jewels to the community. They help people. They heal them, themselves and others. I have a great slideshow. I just didn't get started. My friend, the media guy there, he's staying awake. Really, I'm sorry. I never turned it on. But maybe I didn't. Can you turn it on now? I just want to show you one thing. And then we'll stop. We'll stop. There's one thing. I just want to show you one thing that should cheer you up. Okay? This one. Can you show that? It's just one thing. Is it a pretty picture? Come on. That's a warm-up. I know, we're stopping, right? What? Yeah, we can do questions. I thought you were throwing me out at 8:30. I'm here. I'm here for the duration until the plane takes off in the morning. I'm most worried in Toronto. I think people should really make a special effort. There is a man, or there might be two of them, who captain these ships that go back and forth to this airport. And they were trained probably to take like the QE2 out, you know, into the ocean. And they travel 200 yards back and forth on this ship, because every ship has a captain. And I feel for them. Their meaningful life. They need to practice mindfulness. Now, and I worry about them. Maybe the mayor needs to share with them. Okay. That'll go away? Okay, good. What that is, you can look around the borders of that. Bordering around that are all the medicinal plants that nature provides the natural medicine for people. And there are medicinal waters. Over there you can see some happy people frolicking in mineral waters up on the upper left. And this area is the southern direction, where the warm plants grow because of the power of the sun is strong, like chili peppers and cayenne and different kinds of ginger and things like that are heating. And up there, moon power is strong on the north, and the cooling things like sandalwood and agarwood and eaglewood and things. And on this side are the family of the myrobalans, terminalia, chibulias, and things like that. The different varieties of that, and there's a divine variety that's a panacea type of medicine, the trees in the eastern direction, and the west are water and minerals and things. And there's a vision that the Buddha, that thing is, we said, it's trying to go away, but anyway, never mind. The Buddha, when he taught medicine, he turned blue. He became like a sapphire, and they say lapis lazuli, but that's wrong because lapis lazuli is opaque. And he became transparently blue, which is sapphire. And, you know, he radiated a sapphire light, which is like a cobalt sapphire type light that is healing light. And why it's blue? Blue is the color of hatred transformed into ultimate reality, perfection, wisdom. And therefore, it comes from from seeing through the superficial misunderstandings of the nature of reality and radiating from awareness of the perfect bliss of reality. That's what reality really is, clear light of bliss. And it comes in the form of the dark blue radiance. And it heals everything. And when he radiated that light, everyone present, which were the gods of India, the rishis, the Buddhist bodhisattvas, celestial bodhisattvas, and the Buddhist monks. And they all had a vision, and then the whole laity, and there's a whole city around his mansion there, which you can't see because of the thing, but it's okay. But it's all right, he's there, you just know it. And everyone suddenly saw everything in the world as healing, if you understand how to use it. So even what would seem to be a poison, what would seem to be a disadvantage, what would seem to be a catastrophe or a disaster, if you understand it, can be used to advantage. That's the genius of the human being, of the opportunity of being human. You can, don't worry about it, it doesn't matter. You can see that. So that instead of sitting around saying, well, I'll meditate later, I'll do something, now I have to go to work or I have to do this and do that, now I have a right to be grumpy because I'm overtired, or later I'll do something. Instead of that, you begin to adopt an attitude through mindfulness of seeing everything as something that you can, is an opportunity for you to cultivate yourself, to better yourself, to improve things, to enjoy things, to share that enjoyment with others, to help others, so that The world actually is the best of all possible worlds for you. You make the choice to make it so. But when the medicine Buddha taught medicine, he taught that. And I wanted just to show this before leaving, in that a lot of you are healers, I know. There he is, the blue Buddha you see in the middle. A lot, thank you. His name is Baishadya Guru in Sanskrit, or Menla in Tibetan. And the teacher of medicine, that literally means Baishadya Guru. And when you train to be a doctor or a social worker or a nurse or an acupuncture or a healer, whatever kind of person you are helping, or just someone who is the healer in your family or in your business or wherever you are, you're a healing being. When you do, there's a thing you can learn where you imagine such a medicine Buddha, such a being who is like almost like a divine energy of pure healing, coming from the infinite bliss that is the nature of the universe. And you imagine that that energy flows through you. And although you can't really perceive that, and you have your problems and your faults and failings and misunderstandings and things, but somehow when you align yourself with that activity to be of benefit to yourself and others, that energy comes through you, medicine Buddha. And in medical school, you learn to identify and visualize the medicine Buddha and identify yourself as being connected to the Buddhaverse of the medicine Buddha and seeing everything as medicine. And it's really wonderful to avoid burnout and to find a sort of higher power that enables you to channel something. Of course, you never say to your patient or your client or your person, oh, now I'm channeling medicine Buddha, now you be this or that. You never do that. You don't do that. You just deal like in a total normal way. You're abusing it if you do that. But actually, you feel it. You charge up with that, you know. And I was very sad. One of my students who went to Dharamsala, who was also a medical student at Columbia Physicians and Presbyterian Medical School, they brought back from Dharamsala a really beautiful icon, a tanka, as they call it, of the medicine Buddha. Beautiful, big one, like 7 feet by 4.5 feet of the medicine Buddha with his entourage. Not with the plants around him, but anyway, he's holding the one plant. And he wanted to, there was a new building built, the Milman Center at Columbia Presbyterian and the medical school, and there was a niche there, and he offered it to give that expensive tanka when he graduated as his present to his alma mater, and they refused to hang it. They refused to accept it. They wouldn't accept it. And they don't even teach their own people about the Hippocratic Oath, except at the end, like, they quickly dust off a Hippocratic Oath. And I was upset about it. I'm sorry to be grumpy. But maybe they would nowadays. Okay, question. Yes, yes. Marco says question. So I'm sorry, I'm ranting and raving here. Any questions? Mindful questions. And that means also those who are tired and need to go, please, you can do so. I won't take it personally. All the best. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And no questions? Everyone is too mindful to have a question? We can wait. We can practice mindfulness. Yes?
Could you recommend two or three books on mindfulness?
Two or three books on mindfulness?
Yes.
Sure. Sharon Salzberg's books, any of them, I recommend. I like them. And Alan Wallace, a man named Alan Wallace, has a critique of the overpopularization of mindfulness, which is good in one way, but I think he's too young, you know, and he doesn't, even though it's not the complete mindfulness that the Buddha teaches for those on that path, to just generally help people, he's a little too critical. But it's good to see the deeper dimensions. And then I love Jonny Kabat-Zinn, he's a great guy. Kabat-Zinn is great, and he's so determined to help people become more self-aware. He avoids the stink of Buddhism completely, although he totally learned it from Buddhism. But he doesn't want it because, you know, people, when they hear Buddhism, they think, oh, no, it's a cult, or it's like the Eastern religion, or it's like something beyond them. And they just hear about lowering their blood pressure and being aware and doing a body scan or whatever. helping their skills at work and things like that, they do that. So there is a place for just sharing it and remembering that Buddhism is a service industry, and the skill of how to use mindfulness is a service. And then later, if someone gets better at that, and they will reach a wall, if they're living unethically, if they're living in an unrealistic worldview in the earlier parts of the path, and they'll begin to feel uncomfortable about those things, and then one can be critical of a superficial way of approaching mindfulness at that stage. But initially, just breathe. That's no problem. Okay? And those books are all good. Yes?
I grew up being very empathetic, and I took on my parents' problems, you know. So for me, do you have a response to the heart? How we just, if I say the word compassion, it sounds to me, oh, just be compassionate, it's a mental construct. But if I took it on, maybe that was karma, well, how do you get out of taking on other people's stuff?
You don't want to get out of it. That's very good. You took on the karma of your parents, you're saying? Of course you did. Everybody, that's the great thing about karma. You see, we have that's another book I'll recommend. It's my translation of the Book of the Dead, especially the introduction. So-called Book of the Dead. It's actually, the real title is the Book of Natural Liberation in the Between State. Between Death and Rebirth, that is. You know, it's not Book of the Dead is a mistitle that the first Western translation put on that has stuck, kind of. But when you're reborn, when you die, the mechanism whereby you die and are reborn, the way the Buddhists report, the Buddhist investigators, explorers, and scientists, and psychologists who explored the after-death state, and they explored the out-of-body state, and they explored lucid dreaming, they explored all these kind of things, I call them the psychonauts, like astronauts, you know, but psychonauts. They went inside the psyche like an astronaut. And they report that when you die, you dissolve out of your coarse mind and body, of the five senses, and most of what your brain is involved in is your sense experiences, and most of what you remember, and then the sixth sense, which is your thinking sense of what's in your inner mind, and you dissolve out of that, and you lose your grip of language, and you lose all of that. And then you go into your subtle mind, which is an energy in your central nervous system, and then, which is throughout the body, actually, because the central nervous system includes the spine and all kinds of other nerve centers throughout your body, not just in the head, and which is big because it's where the main most of the senses are. And then the super subtle mind is like almost like a single cell. It's like smaller than a molecule. It's subatomic. It's like the Higgs boson. It's so subtle. And that's what they call your spiritual gene, or your, if you don't like the word spiritual, your mental gene. And that is where is encoded your basic kind of predilection as a living being, as a continuum. It's not a fixed thing, like an unchanging soul thing, but it is like a soul energy in that it's super subtle, but it's not non-material. It's embedded with pure energy, completely interwoven with it, and the material is mental, and the mental is material at that place, and it's the third gene. And then you are unconscious for some period of time, although your whole being has dissolved into that. But then you have like the equivalent of a dream. So you go like when you go into a deep sleep, and you pass out and you die, right? And then when that leaves the physical body, and especially it's near at the heart center, you said from the heart, so that made me think of it. When that leaves the body, is what that's considered to be the state of death. And it's where you have an awareness of what's called the clear light of the void, which if you're not trained, you'll miss. It's like going through a doorway or a pane of glass. You don't really look laterally through the glass. You just go beyond it. Then you have a kind of dream state where that gene produces an embodiment sort of similar to the one you had in a previous life, but like a dream body, you're not really aware of yourself as a body, but you're in an environment and you're having experiences. And you go on for a while in that state, like in a dream, but this is a different dream because you're not going to wake up back again in that body, although you don't know that, unless you've rehearsed it and practiced it, which you can do. And then You cruise up and down, I don't know the streets, at University Avenue or something, and you meet couples, you see couples who are getting it on, and you like a particular one, you're drawn by something, and you have a preconception Oedipal experience if you're going to be a male, and an Electra experience if you're going to be a female. And you get into it with them, and you enter their passion. And of course, if they're particularly haven't been studying Masters and Johnson, you have to find it at the subliminal level, and unfortunately in some cases. But you enter that, and you pass out, and then there's this wonderful, I forget the Canadian flag, but the French and the American flags are red, white, and blue. So there's this wonderful moment where, in the symbolism of the Buddhist thing, where the red cell of the mother and the white cell of the father meet, and they surround the blue cell of your third gene, which is your gene from your previous life. So you fell in love with your parents. It's how you were born as their child. So that's taking on their karma. And you did do so, I mean, in the Buddhist view, you did do so because probably in a previous life you might have been their parent. And we've all had infinite previous lives, so we've all been each other's parents, actually. Every single one of you here, including the guys, has been my mom in a previous life, logically speaking, including you, the man who asked the question. He's smiling. You're my mom, and I apologize. I apologize for biting your nipple. And I hope you gave me a little flink on the cheek, you know, didn't read some book like, you know, to wise me up about your sensitivities. But on the other hand, I was your mom too in the previous, because once you have a beginningless universe, you can't say anything didn't happen. And so that's a way of meditating compassionate kinship with all beings, like we feel compassion for our families and children and somebody. If parents bother us, we feel it for their children. And we everybody's mom somehow. We have this, there's this way of meditating. And so it's your life purpose is the karma of your parents, of course. But on the other hand, what's great is, so the parent can always say to the child, they say, I didn't ask to be born in this family. Child says, parents say, yes, you did. You picked us out of the bardo. You landed in the womb there, you know. And then, but the child can say, you didn't make me. I have my own life. Yes, they do. You just help them have a body. And it's quite nice, actually. It's a nice biology. It's not a dogma. It's not absolute. You know, there might be a better way. A future Buddha might come up with a better way of explaining evolution, multi-life evolution of individual beings forever going on, interwoven with each other. They might have a better way of explaining it, because there's a Buddhist philosophical scientific thing that all theories about relative things are relative. They're valid within a certain context, but they're not absolute dogmas, because they're not about the absolute, they're about the relative. So it's a very good explanation, though. The karmic evolutionary. It's pre-Darwin, and it shows the relationship of the human and the animal 100%. We've all been every animal, all of us. We've all been chickens, we've all been cockroaches, we've been everything, all of us. And every animal has been human, but they didn't do enough mindfulness practice when they were human. And now they're back, like, you know, where they can't do it because they can't read Sharon Salzberg. And they can't come to a lecture like this, you know? So don't worry about it, being empathetic. Be more empathetic, that's fine. Look at, you're happy looking. You're smiling right now. I can see that smile on your face. You're Mr. Happy. And yeah, you feel other people's misery a little bit, but then because you do, you want to cheer them up, and you're good at it because, you know, that makes you good at cheering them up because you're feeling their misery. It's like you're good at not putting your own hand in the fire because it hurts. So the more you cultivate empathy, and the more you develop compassion, the better it is. But the way to avoid burning out and freaking out is, you have, by mindful awareness, by intensifying your awareness, by developing wisdom and samadhi, you have to find the deepest nature of freedom of the universe. You have to follow your bliss, like Joseph Campbell famously said. You have to find bliss, and a little bit of it is a taste of reality. And it is about that, and don't feel embarrassed about it. Okay? And that way you can take on more things of others when you are happy yourself. So your duty is to be happy. It's one of my slogans. It's all of our duty to be happy. It isn't just like it's a choice and it's a duty to be happy. It isn't we have to wait for somebody to make us happy. We choose to take advantage of things to find the good side of it, and then we can be happy with it. And my slogan is, it is our duty to be so happy that even if they kill us, we'll die happy. That's my slogan. People don't like it, actually. I like it. Yes. Yes, ma'am.
I just wanted to know what your thoughts were on in approaching, like, treating patients with addiction and using mindfulness techniques to help treat patients with addiction. How
yeah.
to kind of go about doing that? And if you've seen it work, and if you've seen changes, and how you can incorporate that into helping treat patients.
Yes, well, I think any degree, addictions, of course, are very difficult. Alcohol and nicotine are the worst, actually. Worse than crack. They are. I believe it's medically established that they are the worst, although there's big companies trying to pretend not. And all addictions are difficult. And mindfulness helps any addiction, but it won't necessarily immediately cure it. You know, it's like people who go around saying, oh, just meditate and they'll be fine. That's not true. There's a much larger thing. They have to learn something. They have to study. You have to take them down and show them, like a smoker. You take them to some lung ward where people are on machine lungs and things. And they show them in formaldehyde, like a smoked out lung, you know, like Dr. Oz does. That's all good. So learning is part of it. But mindfulness in general about being aware is very good. And there is one thing that I have to say, although it might be even illegal, and that is, you know, psychedelic drugs or substances have been proven. Stanislaus Grof worked at Spring Grove in Maryland for many years, even after Nixon had made LSD illegal, with low doses of LSD with alcoholics, very high success rate, very strong success rate. Ibogaine, an African thing, is known to be very, very good in heroin addiction and I believe also alcoholism. And the fact that the authorities, the idiot authorities of these different countries started their drug war, and they banished these things and lumped them in with stimulants and things like amphetamine and things that are harmful, these kind of things, rather than have them used professionally in a responsible way by people, has been very bad. And look at that, you know, addiction is so powerful and such a deeply entrenched thing. What is an Ibogaine, administered session of Ibogaine, do to someone, but put them in a state of a horrifying mindfulness of what they're doing to their body for 12 hours or 24 hours, monitored by professionals and taken care of, because it can be a little bit hazardous. But still, it's very powerful, and it has a lot of success with that, with nicotine and with alcohol and heroin. And the fact that that's barred from people and they have to go to Holland or the Caribbean or somewhere to find a legal place to do it is really stupid. And, you know, we have to be more sophisticated, and we have to get out of the clutches of Big Pharma, who wants to sell us all the Zoloft and all this other weird things, and then makes illegal things that are less harmful. But anyway, to whatever baby step degree that someone can gently be nudged to mindfulness without any religious overlay, without get old Kabat-Zinn up here, tug on his little goatee and like teach them a little mindfulness, or get Sharon up here and talk about her latest, you know, flight on a stalled trip on the tarmac in Detroit, and how she was using mindfulness to be cool with the man shouting and freaking out in the seat next to her. That's very helpful, and people should be more exposed to it. So thank you. Are you a Vipassana practitioner? I presume so. That's good. But Vipassana, I just want you to know, Vipassana doesn't mean mindfulness. Yes. Smriti or sati is what mindfulness is. Vipassana means analytic seeing or critical seeing. The V part is like dividing. It means to divide in its prefix. And pashyana is a gerund meaning to seeing. So dividingly seeing. So it actually is critical, and it is basically what it is looking through body and mind to see the lack of that psycho-fixed separate self that we wrongly think is what we are. That's what Vipassana really, and mindfulness is the sort of ramp up to get into that, which means remembering. But the deeper one is seeing through and breaking free of the psychotic idea that there's some part of us that is disconnected from everything around us. And therefore accepting the experiencing, even finally, not just believing, but experiencing full connectedness with everything. That's what Vipassana actually means, or Vipassana in Pali. That's what it means, okay? So just so you know that, philologically. I can't help myself, I'm a translator. Yes, sir, you have a question, I can see you. You have a big smile and a question. Oh, no, this lady, ladies first, ladies first. Yes? How about anger? You know, my. Are you hearing clearly what you're saying?
How do you transform anger, transmute it?
How do you change anger to.
How do you transmute anger to happiness or become like the Buddha?
Become like Buddha?
The blue one.
Okay.
How do you transmute the anger like the blue Buddha?
Oh, like the blue Buddha! Well, first, you have to get a handle on it. The way you ultimately do is that you talk back to anger. And that is because once you have seen through the psychotic notion of an absolute self inside there, the impulses that arise in you become somewhat, the absoluteness of those impulses, their absoluteness becomes eroded gradually. It isn't just a one burst thing, like a quick gimmick. It's a gradual erosion. And, you know, the reason anger is so destructive, hatred and anger, is that when it arises, we become helpless tool of it, because it seems like the absolute thing and the victim of our anger, or even if it's ourselves, if we're banging our own head against the wall or something, or driving ourselves off a cliff in some jerky, crazed thing, there's this seemingly absolute impulse that we can't resist. You follow me? So the more we do vipassana, seeing through, by looking for the self, looking for that, saying, okay, I feel there's an absolute self there. We acknowledge that in ourselves. That takes a little work. And then we look to find it. And then we don't find anything absolute. And then particularly the modern person has to make sure that we don't find that nothingness is the absolute. And that's a danger in modern materialists approaching Buddhism. They think emptiness equals nothingness. In fact, some translators used to translate emptiness as nothingness. There was one who had a professorship up here in the colder part of Canada who used to translate it as nothingness, which was a very bad mistake. It is definitely, they have a word for nothingness in Sanskrit and Tibetan and Chinese and everything, and it's not the word for emptiness. Shunyata does not mean nothingness. It means something's there that's empty of something else, right? So, it's not like there is an absolute self that you destroy, or an absolute ego that you destroy. You discover there never was an absolute ego or self. There's only the relative self. And the thing that discovers that is the relative self. So it doesn't mean there's no self. There's a relational one. So the way to ultimately do that and turn it into the blue light is to realize that the absolute is all of this relativity, and that makes one capable, gives one the leverage within the relativity to question and to judge and to shape and to try and to modify and modulate every relative manifestation. So when a relative energy emerges that is an aversion to something, an irritation with something, a negation of something, that can be discussed. It's like, I have to get that person or do that, destroy that. And then another voice can come and say, who has to do what? To who? What? And then you can have more leverage over that voice, you see. I always say that this is one of the huge benefits why I'm against the Buddhist types who there's a kind of backlash, who are writing books and quoting sutras and saying this medical school mindfulness or this you know, brain break mindfulness, Shirley MacLaine, brain break mindfulness, or this kind of thing, or that kind of thing. This is not the real Buddhist mindfulness, they go on about. Because it's this non-judgmental thing. But I'm against that, because any mindfulness is good. Because the more you become mindful, the more you remember what's there, the more you're realistic about it. And the more you're realistic about it, you see through unrealistic, fantastic constructs in the mind that are twisting our mind into thinking we're some absolute thing, which we're not. And so it's good. Any looking at something clearly is good. And then, and because ultimately, reality is bliss. Realism is finding bliss. Realism is wisdom. Wisdom is realism. Wisdom is not some fantasy of space being somewhere else. Right? So that's how you do it. And then in the meantime, when you lose your cool, you don't get all completely freaked out. And you do like Thomas Jefferson, you know, you count to 10. And if you're really mad, you count to 100. You breathe 100 deep breaths. Jefferson said that. He didn't have the Dharma. He just figured it out because he was a bodhisattva, you know? So you do baby step things. And especially there is a theory, there's a beautiful book by a Westerner called Anger, the Misunderstood Emotion by Carol Tavris. My God, I remember the name. And where she talks about the hydraulic theory of anger, that it's like builds up pressure and you have to vent. But that's she debunks that from Western point of view. The venting builds up the habit of getting angry, and it's not necessarily good. And it's better, of course, you don't want to repress awareness that you have, that something makes you angry. And actually, for women in particular, I always uphold my wife as a great paragon of how to deal with it, and that is be aggressive and rude with the jerk before he makes you really angry. And that way you will be effective in some kind of intervention. And you know, you get him on after one or two stupid sentences about Dick Cheney or something, rather than two or three paragraphs where you're gonna blow up and be clumsy and then get counter reaction, you know. So you'd be rapier-like and humorous, and that's the female way. You just get in there ahead of time and put a stop to it, or leave ahead of time when you're still happy. The key to defeating anger on the baby step level is to do not allow frustration to build up and to lose your good cheer. Be of good cheer, as Jesus said. And when something is making you uncheerful, act right away while still cheery. That's the key. One more question. Okay, the happy man over there, the smiling man.
Thanks, Sadhguru.
Yes.
I was wondering what the role of imagination is inside mindfulness, accounting for unseen things.
The role of imagination is huge, of course, because, believe it or not, whatever what you're seeing and hearing here right now, you're imagining the whole thing. And we are co-imagining it with you, because we have a language of color, blue, red, white, etc., person, jacket, temperature, room, light. You know, we have all these things, and we see in those categories, the brain really quickly comes in and covers over the buzzing, blooming confusion that is going on of neurons and photons bouncing around, and the wild and woolly thing that, in case anybody ever, you know, joined the mayor or had a little thing, you realize the world is buzzing with energy of a different way. You realize that. And we are organizing that, and that is our routinized imagination. And the way we routinize it is we forget we're imagining it, and we think that it's just over there on, that our concept is plastered over the thing. So the red shirt of that gentleman is, the red is on the red shirt. We don't think that we're projecting and we're constructing in our brain the red. That is the light wave that's coming here. So if we have a certain, some people are colorblind. So the more we analyze, the more vipassana that we do, the more we become mindfully aware and analytic about the realities around us, the more we realize that things are beyond what we are imagining, and the more we break free our imagination of just being stuck in the routine thing, And then we can begin to shape things into a better way by imagining them in a better way. I think it was Shelley who wrote, "Poets are the unacknowledged legislators of mankind." And what he, I might have been Keats, I have a synapse problem with those two, but I think it was Shelley. And what he meant by that was that the poet breaks the routinized imagination of something, like Emily Dickinson sees a drop of dew on a plant in the early morning. And instead of just seeing a drop of dew on a plant in the early morning, she sees a lantern on the avenues of heaven being held up by angels carrying some little person, soul person, in a carriage. And we suddenly, we go out in the garden, and then we see something new. We see a jewel in the dew, in the dewdrop, right? So, but that means that she by breaking that, the poet's imagination is free, and then they revision something with a new imagination, and then others take that, and then they have a deeper bunch of categories to imagine things in. That's what he meant by that, right? Now, the extreme of that is a Buddha, like a medicine Buddha, who, by understanding emptiness, realizes that everything is pure bliss energy, totally shapeable by a loving imagination, and therefore can reshape the environment for the, but doesn't have any need to reshape anything himself, because he's finding, he sees it fine himself. But to benefit others, he can reshape it like a great teacher can reshape things where others will see them in a new way, their imagination will be freed. And of course, all of us have the routine imagination of, I'm a schmo, I'm a this, I can only do that, I'm just the way I am. Yeah, I have to freak out when I do this, because that's the way I am. I'm just whatever. I'm my grandfather's child. Hey, hey, hey. I'm a guy, I'm a girl, I'm a whatever. And we have all these routine, I can't meditate, what? Oh, no, not me, mindful. No, no, I'm a, like, whatever. I have a gun, I'm American. And we begin to, we see emptiness, we realize we are what we make of ourselves. And it isn't that you can be anything right away, that's a fantasy, but we can slowly reshape ourselves toward anything. And then when you come up with the life-changing thing, that you're not getting out of here, even you get out of that body, you're not out of the scene. We're stuck with each other too. We don't want to go through it. Like, you don't want to be my mom again, and vice versa. So we want to become some kind of higher form of existence, and we can, and we will. And we become really motivated to do it. And as human beings, we have tremendous 5 minutes. And we have tremendous ability to do it. Thank you very much. Good night.